All right, we stopped with verse 10, I think, of chapter 12, right? Chapter 12, verse 10, be devoted to one another in brotherly love, give preference to one another in honor. Once more, I mean, this is going to happen again and again and again over the next few chapters, but once more, I want to impress upon you that what Paul is saying here, and he makes it even stronger in chapter 13, is that the connection of relationship within the community is the purpose for the assembly itself, right? It's what the goal of the assembly is, to create this environment where there's a shared responsibility for each other. And as I've said many times, Luzzatto's book, Masalit Yesharim, is just an extension of Paul's thought, but it's 250 pages of the development of this idea. So it's really, really important to understand that Paul is only giving summary to what would have been the teaching of the community for generations, and certainly for these Gentiles coming into the assembly, something that they would have not encountered before in the Hellenistic Greek world, but has been a part of the Jewish tradition for a long, long time. So it's really interesting to me that when I read something like this verse in Paul, I can turn to Luzzatto and find entire chapters that discuss exactly what Paul's talking about. Okay? And I've made some references to that in the notes that you'll be able to pick up by tomorrow. Okay, so in this particular case, Luzzatto has this great passage, wisdom without humility is idolatry. And so it's really interesting that what he's saying is, yes, you might have all of the information that you need and you might be a very smart person, but if you don't do that with humility, and humility is tapinos, so to be put in the proper order, humility is the idea of recognizing yourself as a member of the community on equal standing with everyone else, regardless of your civil status, because you're all under the sovereignty of God and all part of the purpose of the assembly. So here's what Luzzatto has to say. Oh, by the way, the word here for love for the brethren, you will recognize right away, it's Philadelphos, from which we get the city Philadelphia, right? Okay. It's reciprocal reference between each other. So here's what Luzzatto has to say. Torah represents the accumulated response of the people of Israel to the revelation of the infinite nature of each person's responsibility for another. Okay? So when he says love one another, he's talking about the infinite nature of the person's responsibility for the other. This, in turn, is our understanding of the meaning of creation, which presupposes that we are not responsible for our own being, but rather beholden to another. And of course, we talked about that last time, that Luzzatto's explanation of the creation points to the fact that we don't create ourselves. God creates men from outside. We're not responsible for our own being, and our very consciousness depends on the assembly of people, the community that we belong to. Okay, so really important concept. So, and then he continues in 12:10, where he says, giving preference to one another in honor. And the interesting thing about the word honor, timē in Greek, is that it doesn't have any equivalent in Hebrew. Isn't that interesting? It's a Greek word, right? Every one of us is appointed to some task and is expected to remain at his post and to do the work of the household as well as possible. In the scheme of life, there is no room for pride. And that's basically the idea of give honor, is to recognize, as we talked about yesterday, the fruit of each person and that contribution to the well-being of the whole. Luzzatto would say, spiritual perfection is only as successful as the kind of society it creates. Okay. So let's take a look at 11. Here's the NASB, not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. So there's a couple of interesting things here. The word for not lagging in diligence is really the word for slothful plus the word for spiritual. So pneumati and the Greek word for slothful are the sign not lacking in diligence. But we should consider the range of the Greek word for pneuma, which of course is, you know, the word for wind, spirit, breath, and connected directly to rhema in Hebrew. So this whole idea of not lagging in diligence expands the whole process of what it means to be a living, breathing agent of God in relation to his creation and other people. And so to not lack in diligence is to really pay attention to the animating breath of God in everything that exists. Okay. And he says, not lacking in diligence. What was the other phrase? Devoted in prayer. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. And fervent in spirit is a familiar word for us in Greek. It's zeal. It's the word that from which zealous comes from, zeo, to boil, right? And he uses the term now, doulos, which we've seen before. The idea of being a servant is not just to be one who's employed in the process of taking care of the needs of another, but in this case, doulos is the same word that Paul uses for himself when we translate it as bond servant, but it really means the servant, the slave of the lowest class, one whose very purpose is owned by the master. Okay? So in that respect, I have this really interesting quote from Luzzatto's book, and I want to read to you. There are two functions to the trait of zeal. One function comes into play before we proceed with the performance of a mitzvah. The other, immediately after the performance of a mitzvah has begun. The former consists in warding off delay and making in all haste to take hold of the mitzvah and fulfill it as soon as possible, right? Or as soon as the occasion for performing it is present. The danger is postponement. Okay? So as far as in all zeal, with due diligence, with fervor, what Luzzatto would recognize there and what I think Paul has in mind is to do things as quickly as can possibly be done. Don't delay. Okay? And then he says, desire and its cognate, longing, are what undergird the midah of zeal. We are zealous and act with alacrity because we are motivated by a burning desire to experience the transformation that occurs when the inner and outer elements of ourself are united in a timeless moment of service. So here comes the Yitzhak Hara and Yitzhak HaTov, and what Luzzatto is saying and what I think Paul is hinting at is that when we learn, when we experience the transformation of our Yitzhak Hara in the service of Yitzhak HaTov, which is to benefit another, we experience a kind of transition in ourselves that not only ultimately provides us with joy, but which teaches us what it means to be zealous on behalf of another. We find our desire shift from our own well-being to the well-being of another. And in that experience, we have a hint of the breath of God as God's handiwork moves through us to be of benefit to another. Okay? And he says, finally, this last quote, the right course of action, which a man should choose for himself, is that in which he feels to be honorable to himself and which also brings honor from mankind. That is, the outside community is the measure of the honor that I have. I have my own integrity, and I have the recognition of the outside community as well. It is that course which leads to the achievement of true good, namely, zeal for the Torah and improvement of social relationships. So this is really, to me, it's really interesting because what it suggests is, you know, Christianity has a tendency to turn all of this Pauline material into spiritual instruction, right? So that it's all about having the right heart and doing and feeling the right things in your soul. But if you read what Paul's talking about from a Jewish perspective, it's all about your community interaction. It's all about the social relationships. It's all about your treatment of another person. It's all about those everyday experiences of life that make up our embodiment in the world. So it's very, very practical. It's probably the least spiritual stuff that Paul writes, because he's all about trying to get this Gentile community, that there are these Gentiles that are showing up in the synagogue community, to understand what is happening in the Jewish tradition and perspective, so that they become a reflection of the true perspective of the Messiah and don't act in ways that will offend the Jews and cause them to reject the Messiah. Paul's entire perspective is, how do I get these Gentiles to act in such a way that the Jews see that the Messiah is the center of their being and recognize the value of that for themselves, right? Okay, so let's go to 12. Rejoicing in hope, preserving in tribulation, devoted to prayer. Okay, a couple of interesting words. Okay, so obviously rejoicing in hope, we know these words. We need at least know the word rejoicing, kario, which we've seen before. And elpis is the word for hope. But in the Greek view, this is a very different view than the Greek view, right? The Greek view, which comes from Plato, says that human existence is determined not merely by the acceptance of the present and the reconciliation of the past, but by projection into the future. So as far as the Greeks are concerned, hope is nothing more than subjective projections of a future, of an anticipated future. It's not real. It's like what I dream might be the case, okay? So what Paul has to do is correct that Greek understanding for these Gentiles who come in, and he does that through a connection with the Hebrew idea of hope, which is not a wish fulfillment. Hope in Hebrew is the expectation of the good, and it's linked to trust, betach, and yearning, and it's differentiated from fear. So long as there is life in Hebrew thought, there's hope, right? It's not a dream that offers comfort, but it's a historically grounded expectation. The life of the righteous is grounded in the hope that's implied by the faithful continuity of God. So for the Greeks, hope is like, boy, I wish that would happen. For the Hebrews, it's God has made sure that our covenant relationship will continue. So I have grounds for my hope without having to think that, it's just wish fulfillment. And Paul's making that transition by using a Greek word that has a relationship to the Septuagint that pushes us into these Hebrew ideas, like betach, trust. Okay? So let's look at the couple of other words he has in 12. Persevering in tribulation, and basically that's just trials that we find. It's the ordinary kind of things of life, the vicissitudes of life that interfere with the operation of the Yitzhak HaTov, and devoted to prayer. And of course, the word devoted there is the same word that we would find when we look for an explanation of the word holiness, because as you know from Matthew Wilson's work, holiness is really described by the word devotion. God wants you to be devoted to Him as He is to you. So when He says devoted to prayer, He's just introducing, or He's relying on a Hebrew concept that goes all the way back to the idea of holiness. Okay, so let's see what Uriel does with this, because there's an interesting thing happening here. In 12, he says, as one who delights in the hope, endures the hardship, preserves in the activity of prayer. So here's my question was, why does he introduce the definite article? Because he says, as one who delights in the hope, and who endures the hardship. Whereas in the Greek text, it doesn't have the definite article in the text that we're looking at. And I thought about this and I thought, you know, the perspective that Uriel has from a Hebrew perspective is that it's not just wish fulfillment, as we've said. It is it is the hope in the righteousness and justice of God. So it is a definite article kind of hope. It's not just my wishes, but it's the hope that God's promises will in fact become a reality. So it is the hope that I really am interested in. It's not mine. It belongs to God, right? And the perseverance that occurs is my willingness to adopt God's instructions, regardless of the situation of my life, so that I can continue to please him and be on his path. So both cases are singular definite, not indefinite, amorphous kinds of stuff. As the Greeks might have, might have been thinking about wish fulfillment, but that's not what the Hebrews are thinking about. The Hebrews are thinking about the Messianic kingdom, the return of Israel to its proper place, the fulfillment of the covenant promises. So it's absolutely definite. Okay? So let's take then a look at 13. Contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. And of course, you know that the word saints there is a common word for all believers in Paul. It doesn't mean people of special spiritual status, as it came to mean in the Catholic Church. It's really the word agios, and it just means those who are sanctified or holy. And Paul, by the way, addresses the Corinthians with the same word. So in spite of the fact that the Corinthians have plenty of mess in their assembly, he still calls them saints because, as far as he's concerned, they are chosen by God. They're part of God's people. And that is the qualification that for the use of the word agios. Okay? Hospitality is interesting because hospitality literally means, it comes from two words, philia, which you know is love, and xenos. And hospitality really literally means love for the stranger. Right? It's really interesting that the words that we use commonly for love in the fellowship are the words filial, right? Which means that we have a like connection with somebody in the assembly. So we love them because they are like us. But this word is to practice that with people who are completely other than us, the strangers, right? You know, the word xenophobia that we have today, right? That comes from the Greek word xenos, which means stranger. So what Paul is saying is if you're going to practice hospitality, it can't be with your friends. I mean, you can have hospitality with your friends, of course, but Paul's emphasis is that you have to have hospitality. You have to show the same kind of relational benevolence and commitment to those who are strangers. And of course, think about the audience that he's writing to, and you'll see why this word is so important. Because he's writing to a group that couldn't be more estranged from each other, the Jews and the Gentiles. They don't share the same traditions. They don't share the same history. They don't share the same paradigm. And what Paul is saying is, okay, make good, join with each other. Start this process of being hospitable to the ones that you consider a stranger, right? Philoxenos, show hospitality. And by that, it means include the one who's the outsider. Okay? So 14, bless those who persecute you. Bless and curse not. And bless, of course, we know this word. It's eulogia, right? A eulogy, which is a saying about someone that's a benefit of good. Okay? Eulogia is a good word. Logos, of course, and then the prefix you, which makes it good. Good speaking. Okay? And persecute is a really interesting word here because it's dioko, and it means to follow zealously, to impel, to set in motion. So it has both a good and a bad sense. In one sense, it's the idea of pursuing with the intention for good. In the other, it's to persecute those. So it's the same kind of motion. So you should think of his exhortation here as as taking all of those good motives that you have, all that desire for the benefit of another, taking that and turning it upside down to understand what it means to persecute. That is, to show indifference to another, to not care about their benefit, to harm them, to stand in their way, to block their path, right? It's exactly the opposite of the zeal that he wants you to show for God and his Torah, right? So it's interesting in Greek, he just flips the word around to get you to have a really good understanding of what that amounts to, right? Okay, so let's take a look at 15. Rejoice with those who rejoice.
Skip.
Yes.
Ariel translates the first phrase of that completely differently.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. Okay, so let's go take a look. Let's see, that's 13. Join in and take part of the needs of the...
14.
Bless those who work diligent and avoid issuing profanities. Yes. I'm not sure how he can... I mean, he's going to say that that was in the P46. Since I can't go look at the P46 to find out what he's translating... I'm not sure how that got in there, because clearly the documents that are later than P46 are talking about this upside down zeal, right? So how we got to issuing profanities, I'm not sure. I would have to ask him. Okay?
No, it's the first phrase is different. Bless those who work diligently. He's not talking about persecution.
Oh, yeah, bless those who persecute you. Okay, so let me look in my notes. Hold on a second. 14. Yeah, I don't know how he got that either, because it's exactly the opposite. But it is, since the word comes from zeal, it's possible that he's interpreting the text as though it's saying it's lauding praise on those who are zealous, whereas the manuscript, Nestle Island manuscript, takes it as a negative, not as a positive. So it depends on, bless those who persecute you could be bless those who work diligently on your behalf. It would be the same word understood in its positive context instead of its negative context. Yeah, that's all. I don't know what else to say. We'd have to find out why he decided to go in the opposite direction of the later manuscripts. But the word is the same. The problem is it's a word that means both, right? So which one do you choose? Okay. Okay, let's look at, where are we, 15? Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. So rejoice is the same word as we had previously. Rejoice, we know, from kara, joy. Sinkaro, to rejoice with all of the stuff that goes along with this idea of grace, which is where the word comes from. And weep is really interesting, because in Greek, there are two words for weep. One of them literally means to shed a tear. And it's the word that you find in that very famous two-word verse in John, where it says Jesus wept, right? It's not this word. Right? Jesus wept is the Greek idea of he shed a tear. Okay? And it doesn't have this deep emotional, soul disturbing kind of context. Why? You would think that, by the way, that verse occurs in the confrontation with Lazarus in the tomb. And you would think at that point that if anybody's going to express deep weeping and emotional distress, that would be the point, because Lazarus, his friend, has died. But the Greek is really clear that Jesus only shows the outward signs of, some disturbance, like spilling milk, right? Why? Because he knows that Lazarus is going to come back. So he's not in the same distress as the audience, because he's there with the express intent purpose of bringing Lazarus back from the dead. Okay, so his agony is not the same as Mary and Martha and all the people around, which he remembers he sends away, right? He sends the professional mourners away, okay? But not here, and not in another really significant passage where it says he wept over Jerusalem. In that case, the word is the same as this word, klau, which means a deep emotional distress that actually wrenches your guts over how terrible it is, right? So that's what Paul has in mind here. He's saying, look, it's not a matter of just having sympathy. This is feeling what the other person feels so much that it breaks your heart. And that's precisely what the prophets experienced. And it's what he's saying has to happen in the assembly, right? That you have to have this deep sense of forlornness, this deep sense of abandonment, this deep sense of destruction in order to truly appreciate what's happening in another person. And as we said yesterday, some people, those who have the gift of parakaleo, are able to do that. They're able to come along somebody and really feel what's happening in them. And if we know a person like that, it's a blessing because you really feel like there's somebody who understands. That's what Paul has in mind here. So it's not just having a party and then, you know, shedding a few tears at the funeral. That's not it. It's rejoicing because you have this expectation of God's grace and his promises, and weeping because you feel the same brokenheartedness that God feels. Okay? That kind of intensity is what he has in mind. Okay. And now he says, be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. And we've talked about this before because he uses the same theme from before. And to be of the same mind is this word phreno, which means it's not nous, the idea of a cognitive mind. It's the way that I think. It's me processing the world. Okay. And what's really interesting is that this word in Hebrew occurs in the Qumran writings for the divine insight or wisdom that God has given, right? So to be of the same mind is literally to have the same spirit that God imparts in his graciousness toward the community. So this is not primarily a cognitive idea. It's a consciousness that I see things the way that God sees them. Okay? And then there's this really interesting quote from Luzzatto that I think fits here. That says, consciousness is not driven by needs. It is impelled by the freedom to choose between two alternatives, a choice that is satisfying initially. But whether it is indeed the right choice requires reflection, and reflection requires study, which is the application of reason to the truest, in the truest sense. If we do not use our intellect to reflect on our choices, it is as though our consciousness becomes invisible. We mistake our making any choice at all for our making the correct choice. Since it is the other person to whom we are responsible, our choices regarding our neighbors will eventually define the visibility or invisibility of our consciousness to ourselves. It is not choice itself that satisfies our consciousness, but then our consciousness need for freedom, but the choice to obey the obligations to pursue another's good. So if he's talking about be of the same mind, he's literally putting it in the same context of love for the neighbor, which he's going to basically say later fulfills the entire law. And what he has in mind is it isn't just simply a matter of you making choices. It's you making a choice that on reflection becomes a benefit to the other. And as a result of that, serves the purposes of the Yetzer HaTov instead of the Yetzer HaRa. Okay? All of that is involved in the idea of coming to the same mind, sharing the same mind. Sharing God's perspective on how you interact with the world, and in particular, how your relationship to another goes. Okay? So, and that's why I think he says, associate with the lowly. And here the word is tapinos. It means lowly in the sense of insignificant, poor, weak. In the Septuagint, its main reference is to a condition in the state, in the government with the low class, right? You remember, of course, the great beatitude, blessed are the poor in spirit. And one of the possible Greek words is tapinos, but that's not the word that's used there, because the word that's used there is the word for the desperate, not the poor. Okay. But here the idea is in every society, there are those who are weak and insignificant. In fact, you don't have to think very far to realize that God himself becomes the advocate for the poor, the orphans, the widowed, right? Because no, the king is supposed to speak on their behalf, but if the king doesn't, God does. So this theme runs all the way back into Hebrew thinking, where the real test of your ability to have the same mind that God has will show up in your treatment of the insignificant, the weak, and the poor, right? How you treat them demonstrates whether or not you have the same heart that God does, okay? Let's see. Not being wise in your own estimation. Here's a quote from Luzzatto. Pride is particularly dangerous because it can be expressed either by excessive self-importance or self-deprecation. Right? I can create, the Yetzer Hara is perfectly capable of making me feel good about the fact that I put myself down. Right? It's got this ability to twist things to serve a purpose even when it looks like I'm being so humble. And he says, the most common expression of pride is pomposity. People who are so convinced that they are worthy of excessive praise, or we might suggest, so needy of it to protect their battered selves, at the expense of recognizing the worth and, more importantly, the burden of another person. Okay? They ignore all who disagree with them, whether ancient or recent authorities. They never doubt the validity of their own reasoning. That is quite a remarkable statement, because if that's what Paul has in mind here, and certainly what Luzzatto has in mind, one of the biggest traps of the Yetzer Hara is to think that I'm right. Okay, as I've said in today's word a few times, you have to be willing to give up the idea that you're right. Okay, because otherwise you can't learn, and you'll never change. Okay, so he says. One more quote. The most insidious type of pride is that which expresses itself neither in arrogance nor in excessive humility, but in indifference to others. The teachers are more susceptible to this type of pride than all others. Those who deal in wisdom easily convince themselves that they possess it. And this is an abomination. Right? So you get to remind me all the time that I'm just one of you, a student, and just trucking along as best I can, dealing with the issues in my own life. And you know, it's really interesting, just as a personal reflection. Some years ago, I had a couple that I'd met on a plane for Chicago. They became really good readers, and he was a family therapist. He unfortunately died of cancer a few years ago. But I used to spend time with them, and John would tell me that the most significant today's words that I wrote were ones where I revealed my own vulnerability. And he said those mattered to him more than anything, because all of the scholarship, all of the erudite academic stuff was anybody could do that. If you have the resources, if you have all the books on the shelf, you can do it, right? You don't need me to teach you what that word means. But he said, the vulnerability is what really mattered. And I've learned to appreciate that he said that more and more, particularly in relation to this idea that the burden on the teacher is much greater, because, you know, I'm the one who has to bear the weight of responsibility for what you learn from me. And hopefully that becomes something that matters to you and is important to you. But I'm always, always open to correction. So I get things wrong all the time. Okay, so let's look at 17.
I see.
Just
a note on that.
No, yeah. Adi's going to tell me, yes, that's right, you do get things wrong all the time.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was going to tell you, I think I've shared this with you before, but I want to share with everyone. Out of all these years I've been learning from you, the thing that matters most to me is your personal experience. Your knowledge and information I can get from the internet. I can read, I can sit down, read the book. That's fine. It's just information. But when it comes through you, through your personal experience with God and your dealings in life and your struggles, it shows me that you are like me, because I'm going through exactly the same. So that matters quite a lot. So the thing that I learned most from you is from your own experience, not from your teaching as such.
Okay. I'll try to, thank you, Adi. I appreciate that. And I really am trying to make an effort, especially this year, to really open up more. I mean, it's always, for me, it's always a kind of, you know, double-edged sword. I feel the importance of the vulnerability, but I also have a yetzer hara that doesn't want to say, oh my gosh, I'm damaged, right? I'm damaged goods. And so it's hard for me to come, because look, I think, oh my gosh, all these people are looking at me as though I'm the one who's supposed to. I get emails all the time. Well, what's the answer to this? And I said, I want to throw up my hands and say, hey, go figure it out. How do you expect me to know all this stuff? I mean, I'm just struggling along here as well, right? So that's a, you know, in the academic world, that's a very dangerous place to be. Because in the academic world, of course, this statement from Luzzatto is exactly right. Academics believe that they have to be right. No one will listen to them if they feel like they're maybe right. You know? But the truth of the matter is that that's the way life is. And I think if we're going to read Paul and his concern for these people in this audience, we have to read it with very personal kinds of emotions attached to it, right? That his heart is bent on trying to have his fellow Jewish brethren understand his position. And that means he has to be vulnerable. He has to express himself in ways that when we look under the text and see what words he chooses, make him just like us. Right? There's no spiritual heroes in this thing. It's everybody's just trying to deal with what life throws at them. Right? So, yeah.
Anyway. So Skip, yes. Do you think we'll ever have a sequel to The Hidden Beast?
Yeah, it's called Tombstone.
That's a good one. Says, go for it.
Where it says he tracked. Maybe I need to write the book, you know, Message from the Graveyard. So.
Okay. That'll be a very good one.
Oh my gosh. That's a difficult question. Okay. All right. So let's leave all that emotional stuff behind and go look at the academic stuff. So that's safer, right? 17, payback. And this is really the reason that this is such an interesting verse is because the word for payback here is didymai, which means to give, right? It isn't like payback, like I owe a debt. It's the word didymai is really, really important in the New Testament because it's all about God's gifts. That's what happens. And the focus, by the way, for didymai, there are other words for give. The focus for didymai is on the giver, not the gift, right? It's the quality of the giver that matters in didymai, not the gift that's giving. So in that respect, if you think of God's grace as a gift, the emphasis is not on the grace. The emphasis is on the God who gives it, which is really, really interesting. It shifts our perspective away from something that I get as a reward or something that I've been given, maybe not as a reward, but something that I have and I put on the shelf or I stick in my spiritual safe called grace. It's not that at all. It's the giver that matters in this thing. Okay? So, didymai, right? And again, we run into the same word that we've had before. Never pay back evil for evil. And the word is kakos, of course. We've had that before, right? It means, but what's interesting is it doesn't mean evil like reprobate. It means evil in the sense of unserviceable, incapable, bad, weak, ruinous, right? So he's not saying, and when Paul's used this word before, because we've had it before, he's not saying that it's just a matter reprobate action, of immoral acts. What he's saying is that the whole idea of evil is something that doesn't work. And of course, it doesn't work from God's perspective because it's antithetical to God's purposes. It might look like it's working in the world, But the truth of the matter is, anything that's unserviceable to God falls into the category of kakos. And that's a lot of things, right? Much more than our idea of moral evil, okay? So kakos in the Old Testament is related to and arises mainly in connection with concepts like amartia and adikia. Remember we looked at those? Sin and lawlessness, all connected to the covenant, all connected to the Mosaic Code. So kakos corresponds to the Hebrew stem ra, right? Though it is used often in other forms as well, and it brings out impressively the moral judgment of Judaism, which is based in the Mosaic Code. So you can't even read this verse 12 chapters into the Pauline letter and not think, oh my gosh, this is also Jewish. It's connected to the relationship to the Torah, right? Kakos is anti-Torah. That's what it really amounts to. Okay. So he says, and he says, respect what is right in the sight of all men. Now that's really odd statement, don't you think? Because if I respect what is right in the sight of all men, I'm going to be culturally dependent, aren't I? What is right in the sight of the Romans? Is that what Paul's saying? You know, you need to respect the things that Julius and Augustus put in place, and if Nero's the emperor, then you need to respect because it's right in the sight of all men, right? That can't possibly be what he has in mind. And let's see what Earl has to say, and then I'll make some comments on this. So this is verse 17, and Earl says, return evil to no one as a payback, and so now we know that that means a gift, right? Purpose doing good things before all men. That's a little bit different than respect what is right. Because Uriel's point is that it's an action, not a status, right? Uriel says, purpose doing good, not respect, okay? And look what he says, purpose doing good before men. That's different than respect what is right in the sight of all men. So we need to look at this a little bit. So I did, and here's what we find out. Respect what is right in the sense of all men comes from the word for to care for or to foresee, right? To perceive or to think, okay? And the right, of course, is the opposite of kakos. It's kalos, and it means what is powerful, excellent, strong, healthy, suitable, serviceable, beautiful, attractive. It's exactly the opposite of kakos, which was unserviceable, weak, morally defective, etc. Okay, so he's saying it has to be right in the sight of all men, and right means all of those things. So what does that mean? In the Septuagint, this word is used for useful, beautiful, and morally good, right? Which means that Paul has in mind not what the culture decides is right, what all men decide, but what is right in the sight of those who are Torah obedient because they understand what God thinks is right. Okay? So in the sight of should probably that translation removes the Jewish flavor of what Paul is doing. And that's why Uriel can say purpose doing good things before men instead of in the sight of all men. Okay? Because look, if Paul is going to be consistent, then he can't say that your moral foundation is going to be determined by the culture. Keep this in mind, because in about three verses, we're going to get to a really critical verse that changes everything about the way we think what Paul is endorsing when it comes to the government. Okay? And he sets it up right here by saying, listen, what you need to do is think in terms of what is right in the sight of all men, not respect what all men think is right, but what is right in the sight of all men, which is the Torah code, right? Okay, so let's look at 18.
So, yes. So Stern translates the 17th, repay no evil for evil, but try to do what everyone regards as good.
Yes, very good. That's what Uriel's saying. He purposed to do good before all men. But the NASB removes that Jewish flavor by saying, respect what is right in the sight of all men. But it's not right in the sight of all men. I'm not looking at the culture. I'm looking at, as Stern points out, I'm looking at those things which the Jewish Torah endorses as right and are right for all men. Okay? So read your translation one more time, Lindy.
It says, repay no evil for evil, but try to do what everyone regards as good.
Yeah, try to do what everyone regards as good. But Paul doesn't mean everyone in the entire world, because there you'll have lots of differences on what is good, right? What he means is that all those people that he's addressing who fall under this purview, and he's been talking about Torah instructions for this entire chapter. And he's going to talk about more about those in the next chapter when he addresses the Gentiles who think that they have freedom now that they have come into a relationship with God that excludes them from Torah obligation. So everyone, all men, everyone, it still pushes us away from the idea that Paul is very selective in his moral categories. He is a Torah observant guy. And so Uriel is probably more correct when he says to purpose to do good before men, right? Okay, so let's look at 18, because the same theme now he's going to, remember, there's no chapters and verses in this letter, right? So now we're getting a theme that he's going to pursue for the next 5 or 6 verses, even though we have a chapter break. So let's see if we can get there. He says, if possible, so far as, this is NASB, if possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Okay, so no problem. We understand the word peace, shalom, well-being, right? In Greek, it's erene, and erene just means to not be at war. The Greek idea of peace is no war, but the Hebrew idea is well-being. So Paul's thinking in Hebrew, so he certainly doesn't mean just try to avoid conflict. What he's meaning is that you should experience shalom, right, which in every aspect of life. But the interesting part of it is this, if possible, right? Because my translation in NASB says, if possible, which means that it's a theoretical idea, if it's possible, right? But that's not what the Greek word means. The Greek word comes from dynamos, which means energy. So it should be, if it's in your ability, it's not just that you think it's possible, but that you can actually do something about it, okay? So let's see what Uriel has to say. Rising out from you, insofar as possible, promote shalom. So we got the shalom piece, but I would make it even stronger. I would say that everything depends on you. Therefore, it's not just a possibility. It's an actuality that you need to energize, right? In other words, you wouldn't say to yourself, well, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. Wrong. There's always a yitzhar hara, yitzhar hatov choice, so you can do something about any of these situations. The question is, will you? Okay? So, in your ability, if it depends on you. Now, that's an interesting phrase, because if it depends on you, let's see if I have here, so far as it depends on you, in the NASB, is added to the Greek text. It isn't there. So look what the NASB did. First, it made it a theoretical possibility. And then it said, oh, you only have to consider the theoretical possibility if it depends on you. But listen, the condition of the United States supplying weapons to the Ukraine doesn't depend on me, so I guess I don't have to do anything about it. I mean, I can be upset about it, but what's the point? I mean, I can't do anything about it because it doesn't depend on me. I'm not the president and I'm not the chief of staff, et cetera, et cetera, right? But that's not what the text says. What the text says is, if you have the ability, make peace. It doesn't say, as it depends on you, because it does depend on you. There's no possibility that it doesn't depend on you, because that's what choice is about, right? So, the Greek concept here is that the Greeks were primarily interested in the state and not the individual when it comes to irene, peace, right? But the Hebrew idea is the individual, the local community, the family unit. If you have the ability, and you do, because you have yitzhar hara, yitzhar hatov choices, then make peace, right? In other words, create a situation of well-being. Okay? Okay, and now he's going to continue that, and he's going to explain what that means. Never take your own revenge. And, of course, he's going to cite from a passage. So let's take a look at that. Revenge, by the way, the word never there is the wrong translation of that negative particle, because the negative particle is me, not u. You know, in Hebrew, in Greek, there are two negative particles, u, ou, which means never, and me, which means not. But not conditionally, right? So I might not go to lunch today is a conditional statement. I will never eat that again is an unconditional statement. I would use u for I will never eat that again, and I would use may for I might not go to lunch today. And this, in this phrase, Paul uses may. So he doesn't say it's never the possibility that you will ever take revenge. What he's saying is, Under all conditions that I can think of, don't take revenge. Now, why does he use may? Because God does take revenge. So if he says never take revenge, it becomes an unconditional statement. But God promises that he will. So it can't be an unconditional statement, or you would be judging the moral character of God, right? So he says, okay, for men, conditionally, don't take revenge, okay? Because, why? Because revenge is God's purview. And then he cites this passage. Okay? In the passage where revenge means, this is also interesting. Do you remember, I shouldn't have to remind you, remember the word dikos, dike, dikeos, dikeusine, all comes from our Greek translation is righteous, but it all comes from the word from the meaning of the law, right? Okay, so adikeos is against the law, lawlessness. And we saw that that in Hebrew means something about the Torah, right? So here's an interesting concept that's coming up here. This word for revenge is ekdikeo. It's the same root, and it basically means contrary to the law. Isn't that interesting? That an avenger is someone who operates contrary to the law. So what is the law? The law is God, this is God's purview. Don't mess with what God is responsible for. And if you do take revenge, you are acting contrary to the law. Interesting, huh? Okay. So it occurs only in the sense of God as the avenger and the authorities that God puts in charge to represent him as according to his will, right? To take law into your own hands is our sort of idiomatic expression for what means contrary to the law, right? To take the law into your own hands is to revenge or to avenge. And that means that you no longer hold yourself accountable to the law. Okay? So, this comes from then he cites this passage in Deuteronomy 32:35. And I want to talk about what the word there is, vengeance, right? So vengeance is mine, says the Lord, right? The concept of divine vengeance must be understood in the light of the Old Testament teaching about the holiness and justice of God and its effect on man as a sinner. In terms of the presuppositions of modern Christian theologies, such a God of vengeance will be labeled unchristian and unethical. But that's a misunderstanding the idea of the mercy of God, because divine vengeance can be seen as a necessary aspect of the idea of mercy. God cannot be true to his character of holiness and justice and allow rebellion to go on unpunished. Because even though he shows mercy, the other side of God is a commitment to justice. In the Old Testament, people are reminded that it's only God who can champion his own cause without error. This verse is echoed in Paul. So Paul basically saying, if you take revenge, you're acting contrary to the law, because God is the only one who can decide when vengeance applies. Okay? And then he quotes from, in verse 20, from Proverbs 25:21, which is really interesting. You can read that whole passage. It starts in 25:21 and continues, right? But what I want to concentrate on is the idea of burning coals, okay? Because burning coals is a Hebrew idiom. You can translate it as burning coals, but it's actually a Hebrew idiom that means to pile shame on someone, okay? So it's a figurative expression for producing shame, right? In other words, remember that shame in the ancient world is a very public display. Our modern idea of shame is an internal psychological state of mind, state of feeling, okay? I feel ashamed. It's something that happens inside of me, but not in the ancient world. In the ancient world, shame was public, so it was a loss of reputation, a loss of status, a reassessment of your worth in the community. And so when he says heaping coals on their head, he's talking about public shame. So think about what he's just said. If your enemy hurts you, and yet you care for the enemy, you created public shame for them. In other words, people will look at them as though they were undeserving of your benevolence because of the way they treated you, and that will diminish their status. And that was a very, very important concept in the ancient world. To maintain public status was far more significant than to feel ashamed on the inside, right? And you can see that all the way back into David, because in Psalm 52, David basically says the same thing. It's the public shame that drives repentant behavior. Okay? Okay, so that gives us to, yes.
Can I interrupt and just share two things that happened this week? One in B'nai Brak, where there's a whole big, B'nai Brak is an extremely religious area, and there was a whole protest. And they, Chabad was there. Does anybody know this? The LGBTQ community, and Chabad was handing out, instead of having major protests, they were giving water and they were giving blessings to the protesters, and it quelled some of the, anybody know this?
No.
Okay, so that's one thing. Heap coals on your, I mean, it's not that they're enemies, but it was, instead of the fighting back, it was something that was given by one very religious community to the people that were not. And the other thing is, it was in B'nai Brak, there was the protesters, they were blasting the song Shalom Aleichem, and one, and it's on video, one of the protesters, you know, with the Israeli flag and the helmet and the camera, was moved to tears. So it's like, they were shamed into thinking about what they were doing.
So yeah, I think
goes along with that. So I thought I'd share those two incidences.
Yeah. And I'm sure that that's, you know, look, Paul is very cognizant of the environment that the Gentiles and the Jews operated in the first century. And public reputation was huge. It was the motivating factor behind most of the way that I would think of myself in the community. And so he's pointing out something that's a very practical application of using an important quality of the first century in an effort to undo what the enemy is trying to do. By creating a perception of the enemy that the enemy won't like, right? They'll change their position because of that. Yep. And so the last verse now, last verse of 12. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Uriel has an interesting thing here. He says, don't be conquered by or come under the control of corruption. Instead, overpower evil corruption by means of the good. And I would only remind you that that is a perfect summary of what we have been talking about all this time in relation to Yitzchak, right? The whole point is to be able to overcome the projection of the Yitzchak by turning those that energy and those desires into something that will benefit another, and consequently converting it into a Yetzer HaTov experience. And I think that's pretty much what Paul has in mind there. Pretty much, Paul's basically exhorting these people to take all of that energy that they have for what would be, remember, kakos is unserviceable, not useful, weak, insufficient, to take all of that energy that they've that the Yitzhak Hara uses to defend itself and turn it so that it operates for the benefit of another and experience a Yitzhak HaTov moment where you can feel God's presence and you discover joy in the process. Right? That's, I think, what Paul has in mind. Now, that takes us to verse 13, chapter 13, verse 1 and 2, which are incredibly controversial and require a good long discussion about how the church has used these to prop up the idea of God's endorsement of the government and how antithetical that is to everything that Paul has been writing up to this point. And since we're now at the end of the hour, I don't want to get started on that long discussion before we have time to finish it. But here's what I will tell you. I sent the following documents up to Mark to put on the additional materials. My notes on chapter 12, my notes on chapter 13, which we'll begin next week, and a long discussion that I wrote 10 years ago, or more than 10 years ago, on Mark Nanos' perspective on the intended audience of Paul's letter and what that means for understanding the first two verses of chapter 13. Okay? And that article I put on the additional materials. You could have found it if you wanted to search the website, but I put the article up there so that you get a chance to look at it, because it's a compelling argument that Paul is not in any sense endorsing a government position, right? That he's talking about certain things that happen within the synagogue environment that do not apply to the civil government. Okay? So between now and next week, if you get a chance to look at that, that would be great. And if you don't, we'll talk about it anyway. But we'll briefly touch on it, because all of the detailed material is in that article. Okay. So I guess we're off until next Shabbat. Unless somebody has something to add, we'll be in good shape. No? Okay, I will see you next week, and I hope that I can walk.
Amen.
Okay.
We keep praying for you.
Okay,
yes.
Thank you, buddy. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Skip, let me thank you again. When it comes to vulnerability, what I learned from Brené Brown, which you introduced me to, is an incredible piece. What she did on TED Talks on vulnerability and how those were the people that seem to be succeeding emotionally in life, or those who have come into the realization that they can be vulnerable. So thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I like Brené Brown too a lot. So thanks, Larry. Yeah. Okay. See you next week. Bye.